Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. Tonight we are presenting the first hours of Issues and Ales discussion, recorded earlier this month at CS3. WBOI's Rebecca Green moderated the discussion, and she was joined by a panel of experts to look at the conversations that need to happen concerning the end of life. To introduce the panel, here's Rebecca Green.
Tonight we're going to talk a little bit about the conversation that no one really wants to have. And we have three really outstanding panelists here tonight. We have Kristen Belinsky. She's an attorney, and she specializes in elder law and estate planning and those kind of issues. And we have Mary Willems Akers, who's a social worker with Visiting Nurse. And I want to thank them, too. We'll get to them a little bit later in general, but they've provided a lot of resources for us to use here tonight. So thank you to you guys. And we also have Dr. Ann Moore, who is with the same organization. And so we have a broad, we have kind of all three of these issues. We have the person, the medical issues, and the legal issues. So we're just going to kind of dive right in. We're going to start with Christine tonight. And we're going to talk in general about the conversation. So with this conversation, how have you planned for your end of life with your loved ones? So Christine, if you could walk us through a little bit about the terms and some of these issues that we're going to touch on this evening.
Sure. There's a lot of documents that, there's a lot of confusion about the different documents that can be used to do end-of-life planning. And really, I guess I should back up for a minute. I don't think of these documents just as being end-of-life. It's not something that I encourage just my clients who are elderly or ill to do. Really, everyone should undertake this type of planning. It's not pleasant to think about, but We don't know the future, and I really think that it's better to prepare now and save your loved ones some stress. So I'll try to do a real quick overview of the different documents. I'm a lawyer. We love to talk. We love to get down in the weeds and the details, so I'll try to keep it brief. You've probably all heard the phrase power of attorney. That's used a lot, but it's not, people aren't really clear on what it means. Powers of attorney in Indiana can encompass financial powers, and they can also encompass healthcare powers. It used to be really common you'd just do one power of attorney and it would cover both. It would cover your healthcare needs and it would cover your finances. You would appoint someone to act for you if you were unable to act. It has become more common in recent years to split those out. I'll do a financial power of attorney and I'll do a healthcare document and keep them separate, both for keeping the documents a little shorter and because you may want to appoint different people in those capacities. There's also something under Indiana law called an appointment of healthcare representative. This does largely the same thing as a healthcare power of attorney. The law gets into a little more detail. So what I do and what a lot of attorneys do is we lump that together with the healthcare power of attorney. So you've got a financial document, and then you've got what I kind of generally call a healthcare proxy document. This document, this healthcare document, is designed to appoint someone who can act for you if you're unable to make your own healthcare decisions. Under Indiana law, you and you alone make your healthcare decisions as long as you're capable of doing so. You can be very, very ill, but as long as you have sound mind, you can make your own healthcare decisions. The healthcare proxy only comes into play if the doctor or the healthcare provider is looking at you and saying, this person just cannot make this decision. The document then tells that provider who they need to turn to ask the questions, to get the decisions made. In my mind, in my practice, the healthcare proxy document is the absolute most important document you can do for your healthcare planning. Living wills get a lot of emphasis. I think it's kind of a pop culture or a common myth, and I think my personal theory is this has derived from the Terri Schiavo case that was so prominent in the media about, I don't know, 20 years ago. She was a woman in Florida. She was in a vegetative state, and her husband wanted to remove her from life support, and her parents didn't, and there was a stalemate, and no decision was ever made. Living wills became very popular and very commonly talked about after that, but what people don't realize, and I'm speaking only to Indiana law, but in Indiana, living wills have very little, they don't really have any legal teeth. Your doctor is not obligated to follow the instructions in a living will, and your healthcare representative is not obligated to follow the instructions in a living will. When you sign the living will, you're saying, I don't want to be kept alive artificially if I am determined to be terminally ill. But really what it is it's just an expression of your intent. The person who will be called on to make that decision, if you can't, is the person you appoint in those in that legal document, that healthcare proxy document. So that's the more important document in my mind. But it's not the document alone. I tell all my clients, don't just sign this document and stick it in a folder. You have to talk to the person you're appointing and make sure they understand what you want. And that's an ongoing conversation. As your medical issues change, as your viewpoint changes, even religious viewpoint changes, you've got to make sure that A, the person you've appointed knows what you want, and B, that they will be able to honor your wishes, both able from an emotional standpoint and from a moral standpoint. Make sure you're on the same page with them. A couple of other things I get asked about some, and these may be things that the medical providers here are able to address more than me, but a post form and a DNR order. Sometimes I have clients who are terminally ill, and they're very interested in how do I make sure I'm not resuscitated? And my response typically is that's a hard thing to make sure of. But the two things that in my mind are the most important, if that's how you feel, are a post form, stands for physician's scope of treatment, physician's orders for scope of treatment, and a DNR order. A DNR order is specific to the institution or wherever you are. If you're at a hospital, the DNR order will be unique to your file in that hospital. A post form is like a DNR. You make some of the same direction, but it, in theory at least, travels with you from the hospital to the rehab facility to the hospice home, wherever you may be. So I encourage my clients, if they feel that DNR is appropriate for them after talking to their physician and their care providers, then to do both of these things. Those are not things I can do for my clients. They are physicians' orders, but it's just something my clients frequently ask me about. So. And I would know. I guess I'd know on the bottom of the slide. Sorry, Rebecca, did I take the words out of your mouth?
Yeah.
One thing to note is these documents, you have to be of sound mind to execute them. I frequently get calls from loved ones of someone who has lost mental capacity, commonly from like a dementia type situation, and they want to execute these documents. It's too late. You have to do these documents while you are of sound mind. You don't have to be of perfect health. I have many, many clients who are not in good health who are still of sound mind. But if you have lost mental capacity and these documents are not in place, the only fallback position is an adult guardianship. And that is a court process. I won't go into the nitty-gritty, but it's kind of time-consuming. It's very challenging and emotionally difficult for the family, and lawyers are involved, so it's expensive. So,
as Kristen was talking, I noticed Mary and Dr. Moore, you guys were kind of nodding, especially as she talked about like the documents only get you so far, and then there's the conversation. Yeah. Mary, how do we start these conversations with our families, and why should we do it now sooner rather than later?
I think there are a lot of different opportunities to start the conversation. I know within my own family, having experienced the loss of my husband's lost two grandmothers in the last few years, and my father himself has had some hospitalizations at each moment, whether it be at the point of a diagnosis or as a loved one experiences an illness, it brings up the opportunity to have a conversation with each other and as a family about what our intent is and what our goals are and what we want to have happen should we be the patient in that scenario. So as a hospice and palliative care provider and a social worker with our patients, we start that conversation as soon as we walk in the door. That's something that our team wants to make sure that the family's talking about and that they're fully informed on the decisions that they're making. But as an individual and within my own family, I think any moment we see an experience with someone who we love or someone we know, that's the perfect opportunity to start that conversation.
Dr. Moore, anything you want to add to that?
I would agree with what Mary said. And sometimes you don't know, the sooner the better. And how do you start that conversation if no one's ill and you don't have one of those triggers? And it may be something like seeing something in the newspaper and bringing that conversation up with your loved one. I think probably the most difficult part of having the conversation is starting it. And once you get started, it kind of flows naturally.
Let's talk a little bit about when you're having that conversation, what are some things that you need to take into consideration, like timing and
It's never a good time to have the conversation. Okay. I'm a pretty direct person, and anybody who knows me understands that. It's never going to be a comfortable thing to talk to your friends and family about the end of their lives. You're never going to want to have that conversation. It's never going to be comfortable. It's never going to be a fun thing to do. And it makes us think about ourselves and our own deaths, and that's a difficult thing to face as well. So I think, you know, as far as emotion goes, you should expect that we're going to experience all of that.
One of the things that we talked about as I was planning this is this kind of idea of what do you want for the end of your life? What do you want your death to look like? And that's not something that we talk about in Western culture, particularly I think American culture. It's death's kind of at a distance from us, even though it's not. We like to think that it is. So how do you talk to your patients about that, or what should people consider as they're thinking of that?
So our agency takes care of people in several different sites of care. My team and I take care of patients in the hospital who are either there because they're at the end of a chronic progressive illness or from an acute event that they never planned on. We also see patients in an outpatient clinic, and the conversation kind of changes depending on the location we're in, but it always comes back to, if we have time to plan and the person is able to speak for themselves, to talk about what is an acceptable quality of life. With all of the changes that are happening with healthcare, the newer medications, the technologies, we can keep a body going for a very long time. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the outcome is going to be phenomenal. We can keep people going with machines and they may never wake up. And so when I have my conversations with people, it really is not about specific things that you would or would not accept, but about what is an acceptable quality of life. Sometimes I'm surprised by what people would take. I had the opportunity to be appointed a power of attorney for someone very close to me, and we went through all of the financial plan, all of her usernames and passwords and where everything was, and at the end of the conversation, she still hadn't mentioned her healthcare needs, and I said, well, what would you want if you had a stroke and couldn't speak for yourself? And the response was, well, you know, and the true answer was I didn't. This is someone who is independent and successful and a great artist and a constant learner. And I would have pulled the plug. But when I pushed the conversation and said, would it be okay for you to be in a nursing home with a trach and a peg and someone wiping your rear end, is that an acceptable quality of life? And the answer was yes. My job is to find the right nursing home, and the right nursing home looks like this. So I think... It was very difficult for me to even start that conversation, even though I do it every day with people I'm not close to. And it really does come down to looking at all of the technology. We keep people going for a very long time, but at the end of the day, what do they wake up to and what does their life look like moving forward?
This question's for kind of all three of you. When you're talking about quality of life issues, how do you advise people if they think there's some kind of a conflict in the family? There might be a person who's deeply religious who has a problem with withholding things like feeding or hydration and food, or somebody who, even as simple as cremation versus no cremation, how do you, as the person who's expressing your wishes, how do you navigate that? And how do you, maybe as a family member, make peace?
I refer to my social worker.
I was just thinking, that's why I have a job. As far as, you know, everything should be person-centered. That is the basis of all social work practice, and it's really the heart of what we do at Visiting Nurse. The patient should be the person who's making those decisions, and I hear what you're saying as far as how is the person supposed to express those wishes when they know that the person who they're telling is having some conflict within that. I think really just, I've heard Dr. Moore say in the past, you know, as long as you enter a meeting going in with the hope of understanding, is that correct? Kind of paraphrasing, but to try and have everyone in the room understand where that person's coming from and what's happening. Another thing is well-informed consent, you know. What do the beliefs that we hold actually... how do those work within the context of the care they're receiving? We're very lucky at Visiting Nurse in the fact that we have 5 spiritual care staff that work alongside us. And when any of us gets outside of our scope of practice, we can refer to those spiritual care teams to kind of help put things in context. But the social work team is really in place to help facilitate that conversation and ensure that everybody is heard and that they're well informed. I don't know if that answers the question.
No, it does. And okay. I'm kind of going to go to Kristen for just a second. Are there any, what do you do if there's a legal, like you have competing documents?
If you have, well, that's a sticky question. If you have competing documents, it can depend on what the documents say, what date they were executed. My healthcare powers of attorney revoke any prior ones. They specifically say that, so the most recent controls. Now, a document might not have that language, so it's hard to say. I kind of view it as my job to try to avoid these conflicts or questions about who really has authority. Something that comes up a lot for me is a common scenario would be I'm working with an older couple who has several adult children, 3 or 4 adult children, and they're saying, well, who should we appoint as the healthcare representative? Well, let's just appoint all the kids. And I always tell my clients, it's my job to ask really awkward, uncomfortable, and nosy questions. If I'm not making you uncomfortable, I'm not doing my job. Because I like to get into with my clients the relationship between the children, kind of the different emotional maturity levels when I say children, I mean adult children, but the emotional maturity levels of the children, the religion of the family, if everyone is of the same religion, if there are people who are of different religions. I try to preview for my clients conflicts that could arise, and then we decide how best to avoid them. You can appoint different combinations of people to be your healthcare representative. You can appoint one person, you can appoint several people who have concurrent authority. You can appoint 3 people acting by majority action. Really, you can appoint whatever combination you want, but you have to look at the potential for conflict. I have clients who just literally today signed their documents. They're appointing their 2 adult daughters as concurrent healthcare power of attorney. That can be great because then they don't both have to be present. If you've got a geographical issue and just one is present, you're good to go, you can move forward. That's not so great if they come to logger jam in the waiting room and can't agree on something. And I don't know your family. Ultimately, the decision is my client's. But what I have learned over my years of practice is always assume the worst. And I know that sounds terrible, but these issues are so stressful and so emotionally fraught that sometimes conflict arises that you just didn't anticipate. It can death or illness can really bring out the worst in people because they're hurting. And so I really typically push my clients to having a tiebreaker. Either just name one of the candidates, or if there's a disagreement, designate the person who has the controlling vote. And what I remind them is, if you just appoint one of your kids, that doesn't prevent them from talking to their siblings, but it just vests that final authority in one so that you don't have a Terry Schiavo situation.
And I do want to kind of interject, because I think this goes back to the previous parts of the conversation, which are the documents and the conversation. Mm-hmm. So as Dr. Moore was mentioning with her friend, who she's the power of attorney for, she had that conversation of what do you want? You know, what is it that is acceptable to you, and what are the goals of care? What do you want to have occur at this point in time at each step? So making sure, even if there are multiple powers of attorney, that those individuals are clear on what your goals are, and then filling out something such as the post, which is then a physician's order indicating which interventions you want to have occur. And with that in place, that is to be followed by medical providers who touch that patient. Mm-hmm. So having that conversation very clearly with both parties, if there's more than one party, you know, as a power of attorney, and then clearly indicating on an advance directive what it is that you want, is so helpful for our teams as we're navigating the care.
One of the topics that has been alluded to is the importance of picking the person who will speak for you, because that person gets to speak for you when you can no longer speak for yourself. So even if you have filled out all of the documents that says, yes, do everything, or don't you dare touch me, if your power of attorney comes behind and you can no longer make decision, it all goes away. Yeah. So if you do nothing else, fill out the person the documentation to identify the person to be your spokesperson and have the conversation with that person. It is helpful for that person to be able to bring forward your wishes on paper, but at the end of the day, if I don't like what you say, I can change the decision.
Sure, and that goes back to what I was saying about living wills not being legally binding. You can paper your medical file with living wills, but the person you appoint can override it. So you need your absolute confidence, and the most important decision is the person you're appointing.
The conversation will continue on the other side of the break. Stay tuned.